Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, we hear a story from accomplished television writer and author Ian Gurvitz about writing under any circumstances.
You know, there was also something in my head about the juxtaposition of trying to write an episode for a TV comedy while my mother's in the other room dying. So I sat there blasting through a first draft, patting myself on the back for being so professional that I could fulfill my responsibilities no matter what was happening. On another, I was probably compartmentalizing what was going on. You know, but there we were as adults going through a life-changing moment. So under the circumstances, I had all these emotions that I could put into the scene.
So it must have turned out to be an amazing scene, right?
I remember one time this writer came in late during a rewrite of his episode. He asked what was going on. Somebody said, "We've taken out your crappy jokes and putting in good ones."
Wow, television writing is brutal. Today on Storyworthy, writer Ian Gurvitz talks about jokes and death. Stay close.
Hey, it's Ian Gurvitz, and you can pick up my book, Freak Out, the 2016 election, the dawn of the American democalypse. It's on Amazon and Kindle, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. I'm so glad you guys tuned in today, whether you're a longtime fan of the show of 7 years now, if you can believe that, or you're a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. I hope you guys enjoyed the story last week with comedian Mindy Rickles. She is a funny, funny lady, and I felt like I could have talked to her all night. I mean, just really an interesting person. And her mom, I met her mom, Barbara Rickles, and just really interesting people. So go back and listen to Mindy's episode of Storyworthy. She also, by the way, was in the recent Shotgun Storyworthy, the game show. She came down to the improv, and she was on stage three times, because there's three rounds, and she made it through each round, and she was hilarious. She didn't win, but she was hilarious. Brian Finkelstein won, by the way, if you didn't know. And that episode is up as well right now. But today, you guys, you're here for a really interesting episode. I'm talking with Ian Gurvitz, who is a television writer, director, and producer who's also written four books. What I'm saying is he's accomplished. And he brings forth the topic today, jokes and death. And, you know, most of us have experienced death by now. Pretty much, right? And I was with my dad when he passed away, and, you know, the last 5 days, that all he wanted to do was tell jokes and drink red wine, and he'd say, "Honey, get the chocolate." And we'd drink, you know, chocolate or drink red wine and eat chocolate and tell jokes. One of his favorites, a duck walks into a store to buy some chapstick. Clerk says, "That's 59 cents." And the duck says, "Put it on my bill." Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Jack Blackburn. He also liked the joke, "Hey, honey, where does the 36D bus stop?" And then I'd say, "Where?" And he'd hold his hands out in front of his chest and say, "Oh, about here." So that's where my dad was with comedy. But we really, you know, my dad had such a good end of life. I mean, you know, as it were. He was 81. It was heart failure. But, you know, he'd kind of been going down the hill the last 5-6 months, but we had hospice come in. And so it was kind of, anyway, it was pretty neat, man. It was kind of a beautiful release. I was glad that I was there. And that is what got me thinking about my hospice idea. I'm going to pitch it to Ian right now. This is a little company I want to create with Kathy Ladman, my friend, the comedian. Yeah. It's called Die Laughing. And basically, we send comedians and storytellers to people's deathbeds. To not only, you know, not only be with that person who is ill and dying, but with their family, you know, to kind of like be an icebreaker for storytelling, right?
With nitrous or without?
Sure, nitrous, we can do that. I mean, these are going to be options. There's going to be a website, there's going to be choices, and you too can die laughing.
No, because when I die, I plan not to be there. So whatever drugs they've got at the moment, I'm in for all of that.
All right. Well, we'll entertain your family and friends. That's my point. Anyway, you guys, so I'm really looking forward to hearing Ian's story today. By the way, my dad and I, we like to go out to dinner. That was our big thing. Like when he would come to LA, we'd go out to dinner together, we'd go to the movies, and we'd play tennis.
Yep.
Still pretty much my top three things to do. fact, the only thing I didn't do with my dad was smoke weed, but we drank wine.
Because he wouldn't or you wouldn't?
Oh, Jack Blackburn, that would have been, you know, I think it was a generational thing. You know, my dad was born in 32, and I think marijuana was just, it just had that bad rap where...
Yeah, it had a bad rap for a while.
A lot of people were super fearful, and he had no experience with it. So it was, in fact, I think he actually did have one night that his wife told me about where he got, you know, they had some edibles, and... He got really paranoid. And if you get that kind of high, you're screwed.
No, edibles are dangerous. I actually got my card a few years ago. I thought I'd give it a shot. I walked into this place. I said, just give me the weakest shit you've got.
Yeah.
Because all I remember is like stinkweed from college.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going on. And they said, here's some really light stuff. It's broken up in quarters. So just take a quarter and you'll be fine. I took a quarter, put me into a coma for 12 hours. I'm lying there thinking, I hope this house doesn't burn down, because if it does, we're all dead. I can't move.
I've said that before. Like, if I've ever been, like, super ill, which is not that many times in life, or I've been super whatever, and you lay there and you think, like, if the house burns down, I'm just going to go because you can't move.
Yeah, that was it. So I haven't touched it since. I've got, you know, a shoebox in my closet. I pulled the joint out one time, and it's sitting there, like, tempting me, but I don't know.
Wow.
I don't quite trust it.
All right. Well, listen, my dad and I used to eat out a lot, right? And I still eat out a lot, but also I've been cooking a lot on my own because I found this company called Sunbasket. Have you heard of these guys, Sunbasket?
Yeah, I have actually.
It's a food delivery service. And I'll tell you, just the food is unbelievable. It comes to your door. It's totally fresh. You can choose from all sorts of diets, like, you know, vegetarian or paleo. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah, I've heard. My daughter is into that. So
is that right?
I've heard all these terms. I don't know what they mean. But...
Well, I made last night with my daughter, I made chicken rigatoni with pesto and red bell pepper.
Sounds good.
And my daughter is always so impressed that I'm actually presenting these meals. And then they send this little recipe booklet along with the food. And when my food looks like the picture, I feel so accomplished. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you win.
I do win. It takes the guesswork out of the preparation. It makes the cleanup easier. And you don't have to go to the grocery store.
Perfect.
Any of them in here in LA. Because a lot of us in LA, we go to like 2, 3, 4 grocery stores.
Yeah, it seems to be the way it is. You know?
Well, with sunbasket.com, you don't have to do that at all. And the meals take about 30 minutes to prepare. Listen, you guys, if you go over to sunbasket.com/storyworthy, you're going to get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/storyworthy, and you'll get $35 off your first order. sunbasket.com/storyworthy. You won't believe how good you can cook. Ian, are you going to try Sunbasket?
I'll give it a shot, yeah.
You got to do it. And also, you guys, why not head over to storyworthypodcast.com and join my mailing list? That's all I'm going to ask you to do. That's it. That's my whole pitch today. That's it. Okay, he's here right now, Ian Gervitz. He is a television writer and director and producer, like I said. Now, he's produced over 300 episodes of television on shows like Wings, Becker, The Wonder Years, Get a Life, and Frasier. Every one of those shows I've watched, every single one, like, you know, growing up and well, not even that long ago, they're not that old, but in the 80s and 90s, and my mom was in love with Ted Danson, as so many women are.
Yeah, there's something about that show. Everybody I talk to, I hear.
People,
you
can't
know,
get enough of
my
Becker.
My parents love that show.
Right.
It's like, I'm not quite sure how that happened, but that was the vibe.
And I really liked Wings as well. I thought Wings was a great show. Didn't the creators of Wings die on 9/11?
David Angel, one of the three guys. It was David Lee, David Angel, and Peter Casey, and David Angel and his wife Lynn were on the first plane.
Wow, that's something else,
I was
man.
Actually on stage at Paramount on the Becker set with the creator of Becker, Dave Hackle, who was best friends with them, and Ted, and starting to get news was coming in, and he was calling him and saying, I'm not hearing, he's not returning my calls, I don't like this, and I just had this creepy feeling. You know, it's just one of those things where
you
know exactly what happened, but nobody wants to say it yet.
Wow. Wow. And that was the one from Boston to LA?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, they were coming back for the Emmys. I think they built a house back east, and they were just coming back for one last trip, and then it was back.
Then they were moving.
Retiring, I think.
Wow.
I think David was pretty much done.
All right, Ian, this is going to be such a tough pivot, but I'm doing it.
Actually, it won't. Go ahead.
Ian Gervitz has also written 4 books. He wrote Hello, Live, The Agent, and Other Bullshit You Hear as a Hollywood TV Writer, and that was like a behind-the-scenes account of television development. He also wrote Deconstructing God, A Heretic's Case for Religion. And then last year, he wrote Welcome to Dumbfuckistan, the dumbed down, disinformed, dysfunctional, dis-United States of America. And now he has a new book, if you can believe that. It just came out this past July. It's called Freak Out, The 2016 Election and the Dawn of the American Democalypse. Now, there's a book signing, actually, I wanted to tell you guys about as well. It's here in Los Angeles at Book Soup on Sunset on Sunday, October 1st at 4 o'clock, so you guys can come down and meet Ian for yourself. He's also published a book of original drawings in 2016 entitled Talking Heads. There's so much talent. I can't even believe it. You guys can find him over on Twitter at iGurvitz. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Ian Gurvitz.
Okay, this story is about what it's like working on a TV comedy and having to write a script while sitting in my mother's apartment while she was dying of cancer. You know, it was also about the emotions I was going through at the time and how I tried to channel them into what I was writing. You know, and the thing is, with Half Hour, most people talk about sitcoms, which is a pejorative term for most, as it's, you know, it's just fart jokes and dick jokes. Nothing reflects actual human behavior, you know, and there's a reason for that, which is that most of them are. You know, but I always, to me, Half Hour, multi-camera TV, it's just a play with a three-walled stage with four cameras, and there's nothing inherently stupid about it. It's just how you do it. So you can, you know, I always felt you can channel actual thoughts and human emotions into a show if they fit without getting mawkish or saccharine, and, you know, particularly if you've earned the moment. You know, anyway, the show I was working on was Wings, and it was about two brothers, Tim Daly and Steven Weber, who lived on Nantucket, ran a one-plane shuttle airline. You know, one was straight-laced and dependable, the other one was flaky and spontaneous. You know, typical TV stuff. But it was a solid show, you know, so what happened this time is that I had to write a script, which was part two of a two-parter. Tim Daly's character, who was the straight-laced responsible one, eventually freaked out from the responsibilities of being the straight-laced responsible one and ran away to live a carefree life on some island, leaving his flaky brother, Steven Weber, to step up and run the business, you know, which obviously became a disaster. So he runs to the island to beg his brother to come back, which he refuses to do. So Steven's character has to go back, get his shit together, which he does. But then his brother eventually shows up and they have a heartfelt scene in the plane and they come to a meeting of the minds. You know, so the boring one gets to go wild and the wild one learns some responsibility. Pretty much solid TV fare, you know, not breaking any new ground, but it worked for the show. You know, also during the time, though, when I was working on it, my mother was being treated for colon cancer, and she was living in New York, and we used to fly her out every now and then, but eventually my brother and I moved her out so that she could be near us, and she did fine for a few years. You know, but then things reached a point where the chemo stopped working, and we hit that moment in the basement at Cedars with some doctors saying, there's nothing more we can do. So, you know where it's at. You know, so we took her back to her apartment in Beverly Hills, and she started to fade and ended up in bed. The hospice people came, put her on a morphine drip, you know, which is, I don't know why you have to wait until you're dying for that. Frankly, it's how I'd like to spend most of my weekends. You know, so what happened was my brother and sister and I and my mother's sisters ended up having a three-day vigil in her apartment in Beverly Hills and just hung out. But I was also working on the show, and when you're in production, you know, the train doesn't stop for your life. You need stories and scripts, and there are very few excuses for taking any time off. You know, it's like, my mother's dying, I don't know if I can turn the script in on Friday, and they go, no problem, turn in Saturday. You know, so there's a small window of compassion there. Everybody's sensitive, everybody goes through life, but stuff has to get done. So I got to take a few days off and finish writing this draft for this episode, so I ended up sitting on the floor of her apartment, scribbling on a legal pad while she was in bed, basically drifting away. You know, and on one level, it was just sort of a diversion, something to do when there's absolutely nothing you can do. On another, I was probably compartmentalizing what was going on. You know, there was also something in my head about the juxtaposition of trying to write an episode for a TV comedy while my mother's in the other room dying. It was also sort of a way of withdrawing into myself, you know, being there without being there, or coping or pre-grieving, keeping out the inevitable emotions, or just letting them in slowly. So I sat there blasting through a first draft, patting myself on the back for being so professional, that I could fulfill my responsibilities no matter what was happening. So that's what I did for 3 days, you know, scribbled my way through this draft, which ended in a last scene, which was about the two brothers sitting in their plane having a heart-to-heart talk about their feelings, about the past, how they should be there for each other. You know, and another aspect of this was that my brother was in the room with me, and when we were growing up, we just fought for 15 years, constantly, daily. I have no idea why, you know, but there we were as adults going through a life-changing moment. So under the circumstances, I had all these emotions that I could put into the scene. You know, there was talk about wasted time, regrets, lost moments, lack of communication, all the things you think about at moments like this, you know, and I also knew it was a conversation we'd never actually have. So I got to channel everything I was feeling through the characters, which is sometimes, you know, when you work on TV, it's what you're supposed to do. You know, so the third day came and we're just sitting around and I'm getting my work done. And one of my aunts went into the bedroom and she just came out saying, I think it's over. So there was that moment. You know, so you take a deep breath. We went out for food, obviously, afterwards, because there's nothing more you can do. And then we left for New York for the funeral, but I turned in my script, which was, I was glad I got it done. And, you know, specifically under those circumstances, I was proud of it. I thought it was pretty good, especially that last scene between the brothers. You know, so I went back to New York for the funeral, came back to work, got the obligatory, you know, sorry for your loss, you know, and I started to move on. But that one scene just stayed with me, you know, not just because I thought it would work on the show, but also when it finally aired, it'd be a way of capturing a moment in my life. I'd always know where it came from and what I was going through when I wrote it. So it had a little more resonance than just a scene on a TV show. You know, but with TV, when you're in production, you know, you're writing weeks ahead of time, way before you shoot. But before a script goes to the table, it's rewritten by the whole staff, anywhere from a light joke pass to a page one rewrite. You know, usually you have to sit there while everybody eviscerates your precious words to the point that you don't even want to go to the bathroom for fear you'll lose another joke. You know, I remember one time this writer came in late during a rewrite of his episode. He asked what was going on. Somebody said, we're taking out your crappy jokes and putting in good ones. You know, which was meant as a joke, but that completely describes the experience. You know, and you can't hold on to anything because you just looked at like an amateur pain in the ass writer. So you basically just shut up and let it all go. You know, you smile through it. You know, secretly you're thinking, fuck all you people. And you're also thinking, why didn't I write it better? Why couldn't I come up with these lines or these moments? I suck. I should quit. It pushes every neurotic, insecure button you've got. But, you know, if you're neurotic and insecure, it's why you got into this business in the first place. But in the back of my mind, I was still protective of that one scene because it just had a little bit more importance to me. You know, so the script went through the usual rewrite, but the guy who was running the show, who'd become a good friend, he left that scene virtually intact. You know, I don't know if it was out of deference to the circumstances under which I wrote it or because he thought it was good or some combination of the two, but I felt relieved that I cleared that hurdle and it would at least, I'd at least get to hear it, you know, and I wanted it to work. So we finally get to the day of the table read, you know, and on table reads, you usually know whether you're in good shape about 1 minute in. If the first few jokes land, you're off and running like a plane taking off. And if not, if there's silence or scattered forced laughter, you're in trouble. This was a bomb. Huge bomb. No laughs, no moments, nothing. You could hear people chewing on their bagels. You could hear the effervescence from their drinks. It was just excruciating silence. You know, and then we headed for that last scene, and I was going from anticipation to outright dread. And then we hit it, and it was death. No comedy, no drama, just two people saying meaningless, boring words for what seemed like a pointless eternity. You know, which sucks on an ordinary week, but under these circumstances, it just took the life out of me. You know, and also after a bad table, people usually roll their eyes. They don't look at the writer, but they're thinking, we're going to be here for dinner all week fixing this stink bomb that you set off, so thanks a lot. You know, nobody knew, you know, knew or cared what I put into it or what I was going through while I wrote it or what that scene meant. You know, it was just, it tanked, let's rewrite it. So that's what we did. You go through the usual week of rewrites and rehearsals and, you know, and the show gets better and it got better as it usually does. And I slowly detached from the script as well as the circumstances around writing it. You know, you sit there and grieve for your little words, which is just an ego thing, but letting go of all the lines and the jokes and the emotions was also a way of moving on, detaching from the moment in my mother's apartment and beginning, you know, the actual grieving process. You know, so finally we get to show night, and of course the show played great in front of the audience, and the story was the same, it's just different words and different jokes, but it's still built to that one scene that I put everything into. You know, and even though all the words were different, it was still a poignant scene between two brothers sorting out their relationship, and there were jokes that came from the situation and from character. And there were a few real quiet moments, just as I imagined. The only main difference was that Stephen Weber's character was wearing a clown suit. So if you want to know what it's like, people ask, what's it like working in TV? There, that's what it's like. You put your heart into an episode or a moment, and it ends up getting delivered by somebody wearing a clown suit. So you get a little trade-off between what you put in there and what the end product is supposed to serve. So, you know, I took that for what it was worth and eventually moved on.
Are you kidding me? What do you mean he was in a clown suit?
That was the bit. That's how the week changed. You know, it was supposed to be two brothers just sitting there having honest conversation, straight heart to heart, you know, putting out their feelings. And in the end, it ended up being pretty much the same thing, except one of them's wearing a clown suit.
Why was he wearing a clown suit?
Oh, it went back to the show and how he was coping, and he ended up having to do kids' birthday parties. So eventually he had to put on a clown suit and have a bunch of kids, and that's how low he had to go to keep the business going while his other brother was figuring out his stuff.
Wow.
So it all made perfect sense in the episode, but it's just, you know, you try to put as much bottom as you can into it, and the bottom still gets in, but usually there's going to be some degree of silliness as well, because that's just what ends up working.
What was the name of that episode?
Joe Blows. Tim Daly's character was Joe, so it was Joe Blows Part 2.
Joe Blows Part 2, yeah, and you wrote the first part as well?
I wrote the second. No, I forget who wrote the first.
Okay, and why wouldn't they use the same... I'm just asking because I don't think a lot of... I don't understand it either. So why wouldn't they use the same writer for Part 1 and Part 2 of a show?
Because it's all division of labor, and you need scripts written at a certain point. So if you're working, you know, a month or 2 months ahead of time, you want more people writing more episodes. So other people wrote the first part where he flips out and leaves the island, and I wrote the second part where he gets his shit together and comes home.
Which is the same as how different episodes are directed by different people.
Yeah, usually, unless you've got one solid director for the entire series, you have people coming in for the week.
But Ian, what your story is telling me is that, and I guess, I mean, I know a lot of writers, but I don't think anybody has ever explained it the way you just did, which is to say that it is so impersonal. I mean, you really have to be, I mean, we're all cogs in the wheel, but I mean, you really have to be detached from the whole process.
You need, it's a two-part process. You put everything you have into a script, you know, you go with the outline, you hit the beats, you get jokes that were pitched in the room, you hit all the story beats, and if you care about it, you try to put something more into it wherever you can. You know, the one thing I've always been sure of is that the one joke I thought was just great, the perfect joke at the perfect time with the perfect character, we'll never make it.
You know, that's a lot like the feeling on Twitter when you think you have a good tweet, and if you, the stronger you feel about it, the worse it's going to do.
Yeah, this is the tweet that will change the world.
Why is that? Why do you think that is?
Too much going on Twitter, too much noise, too many people posting.
No, but even yourself, you know, when you write a line, the best joke you think you wrote, and it gets changed.
Just the nature of the business, the nature of the week, you know, things get changed, people get bored. Sometimes if you hear it 2-3 days, everybody gets tired of it and someone else pitches something better or different, and that gets changed.
So, and so what do you say to aspiring writers besides don't take it personally?
Don't take it personally.
That's it.
Because it's a two-part process. You put everything you have into it, and then you completely detach from it as the week goes on because you are feeding the machine. You're shoveling coal into an engine. And ideas will come from everywhere. And usually they're better ideas. You know, 7 people, and that maybe just the writing staff, not including the cast, not including somebody else who's standing around listening. Someone will come up with an idea, a joke, a line, and that many people will be better than one person, ultimately. So you have to care and then not care. And that's the process. And by the end of the week, show night, when someone says that's a wrap and your week is over, it's just basically it's relief. Just mm-hmm. just rerun the son of a bitch and get me some residuals.
Yeah.
You know, because you just walk away. I mean, it depends how much. If there's one thing left, there's a moment, a scene, a joke, then you've got something to hang on to. So you take that with you.
And the following week, it's going to repeat itself.
Same week, somebody else is in the barrel, which is what it's called. It's like, whose turn is this?
To get completely battered.
You know, battered to completely battered to page one. Which sometimes it happens before a show even gets to the table. I mean, I've had some that got total page one and somebody will come up to you before the read and they go, hey man, great script. And I go, I didn't fucking write it because you're in that mood. Mm. You know, so you have to learn how to attach and care. And then on the other side of it, you have to learn how to detach. So that's why, you know, this moment of writing this script, it was sort of a paradigm for what you go through, you know, especially in the dying process, you're attached And then you have to slowly learn how to detach.
Right. It's time. That's what people mean by time.
Well, I've always told people that it never gets easier, but it does get less difficult.
Yeah, because of the process, and you start seeing the bigger picture and how we all sort of fit into this timeline.
Well, you know, you learn you have no choice. I mean, I had a similar experience, same world, about 10 years later when I was on Becker. We went to New York. We boondoggled the trip to shoot some scenes, stunt cast a few scenes and shoot them on location in New York, but it was in February and 2001, and we were just freezing our asses off. It was just brutally cold. And we shot this scene outside the 42nd Street Library with Ted and Paul Schaefer from the Letterman Band.
Sure.
And he was a mime, and Ted beat him up, and it was, you know, the scene was funny, and it worked. It ended up working, but we couldn't find a place for it. But to get ready, we were on location at like 5 o'clock in the morning in this van that was running with heat because it was just frigid outside. And we're having coffee, and it's Paul Schaefer and Ted and I are just waiting. And somehow they got into a conversation about their fathers, who I think by that time had both passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting there listening because, you know, they're the celebrities and I'm the schmucky writer. But what I'm thinking is that we're parked right across the street where my father had had a heart attack and died 20 years earlier.
Wow.
So it was sort of an anniversary. And so they're talking about their parents. And I just sat there listening and looking up the building, listening. And I didn't say anything. Because there's somehow something about it, it just felt more meaningful to keep it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I just sat there and, you know, commemorated in silence.
I think that's really kind.
Yeah, you know, it just felt like the right thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, plus when other people are telling stories, you don't trump them.
So did your mom die first? Or did you?
My father, when he was 44.
Why, how did he die?
Heart attack in that building.
So, that's how, he was only 44.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, I was 19, so it was like 10 days before my sophomore year. So when, you know, I was working in a camp, fell in love with this girl, got a low draft number for the lottery. So, you know, things were looking pretty good.
What was your number?
365.
Wow.
Only game of chance I ever won in my life. It's like cats and dogs were going to war before.
Your lottery to go to Vietnam was number 365.
Yeah, everybody was going before me. And they didn't draft my year. So, you know, for all the bravado I had, going to demonstrations and getting tear gassed and writing whatever I could think of, you know, I wasn't really scared. I wasn't really in danger. So, you know, people talked about going to Canada. I didn't think I'd have to.
Mm-hmm.
And wow. I probably wouldn't have.
Have you written about that experience?
Yeah.
And which book talks about your Vietnam, you know, your protest experience?
In this book, last one, Freak Out, I put in something just about resistance. And it was a little self-indulgent, but I, you know, you only do this thing once. So I put in, this is what I did then.
I see.
Going to demonstrations and being, you know, a person on the street, getting tear gassed, you know, which basically your face burns and your sinuses drain. So, I got my sinuses drained for peace.
Wow, no kidding. Is that what happens?
And yeah.
Where was that demonstration?
It was called Shut Down the War Machine. So everybody was going to come and lie down in front of cars in D.C. So I hitchhiked there with a friend, and I woke up on the floor of this dorm at GW. And I look out the window, and I see people all over the street, and I see some guy lay down in front of some other guy's car.
Oh,
and
man.
And the motorist gets out.
No kidding.
And starts pulling him away. And at the same time, somebody had put the Jefferson Airplane Volunteers was blasting it out of their room up high. So this thing had a soundtrack all of a sudden. So it all got very fascinating.
Surreal.
Yeah, it got like a movie.
I bet. Okay, listen, before I do want to talk about your books, and I want to talk about how politically involved you are right now, but I want to finish up this writer stuff because you have been around for so long. Have you obviously written with partners?
Never had a partner.
Now, how can that be?
Never wanted to. You know, I know people who partnered up for some reason. With a lot of people, they all lasted 12 years, and then somebody wanted to go on their own.
Interesting.
I probably had opportunities to, but I don't know. I just like writing on my own, and you don't want to split the money.
I can understand
that. Which is a rough one.
Sure. Now, when you were writing that script for Wings, did any of your siblings read it there in your mom's apartment?
No, it was private.
Yeah.
You know, so I just sat there.
Well, it's going to be on public television. I mean, it's not that private.
Yeah, eventually it gets out, but it goes out without the meaning that went into it. That stayed private. So it was just me and, you know, at the time, a legal pad.
Yeah.
Which is,
sitting in front of a legal pad right now.
What I did then. but there was just something about keeping that moment private.
Yeah.
that
interesting,
appealed
just like,
to me.
Just like when you were with Ted and Paul, and you kept that moment private.
Yeah, you just don't want to. It's like if you're writing something, people say, you know, what are you working on? It's like, I don't like to talk about it, not because it's so precious, but it's like you get one chance to tell a story for the first time. And until you've let it out, you can sit with it, and it's yours and only yours.
You're such a writer.
It's a neurosis, I'm
sure. So you're editing all the time.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, if you're not walking around with four or five things in your head at any given time and making notes and waiting to see if they develop into stories and what kind, you know, is this a pilot? Is it a feature? Is it something I can sell? Is it too dark? You know, unless you're trying to figure all these things out, do something else.
So have you ever, I mean, this must have happened, where you don't like other writers in the room. You don't like them.
I've never had it get to the point where I don't like them. There was some people you would hire and they would be very, very quiet and not pitch enough. And you'd go, then what are you here drawing a salary for? You know, mm-hmm. It's like fucking pitch something or go away.
Are you talking about like a writer's assistant?
No.
You're talking about
people
staff.
Who get hired, you know, you have a meeting, you read, you hope it's a good call. And a lot of them have been good calls. And once in a while, you make a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, I remember there was one person I thought of, you know, the line in my head was, I've been going to delis for 50 years. This guy is the biggest lox I've ever seen.
Wow.
You know, just fucking sat there taking up space.
And so basically afraid to pitch something because he didn't want to get shut down.
Or was on the wrong show. You know, one thing you can do in this business, you can talk yourself into jobs whether you think you're right for them or not.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just get on the wrong show. I mean, he's worked a lot of different places, but different sensibilities. So,
how many different jobs might you have in a year? I mean, I guess it depends on the year. I mean, you're an artist, so things change. Like if you were on Wings or Becker, that could last for years. But then now you could pick up 15 projects. I mean, what?
It depends. If you get lucky and you get on a long run, I had three, like 5-6 year runs on different shows.
Amazing.
And then development deals in between, which is a nice cushy little thing.
Ian, amazing.
So, you know, someone asked about, you know, what was your career like? To me, it's just like a succession of jobs. And if you're lucky enough to have one hit, then you can say you have a career.
That's an artist.
You want us to stay alive.
Now, the pressure in a sitcom room, as you were describing, is really, it must be where you do have to compartmentalize and take yourself out of it, or really commit to, I can't let anything touch me. I mean, this is just nothing to do with me.
Well, you know, if you've done stand-up.
Of course, yeah.
You know what it's like, you know what it's like to tell a joke to one person and they look at you with a blank face, like, I don't get it. You know what it's like to tell a joke to, you know, 50 people. Well, this is like you're pitching to a room full of, you know, 7-10 people, including writer's assistants. Nobody laughs, you feel like an asshole. But you can't get scared to pitch. I mean, you need to keep your voice going.
Because they all can't be tens.
No.
I mean, like in baseball, they're not all going to bat 1,000.
Yeah, you never will. So if, you know, if you're hitting 300, you're doing great.
And so you really know in the first minute, you know the vibe.
On a table read?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Less than a minute in. It's first page. A few jokes, if they land and people are laughing, you know it's going off and you know it's coming. So you feel pretty confident. They usually don't drop dead midway. But if the first few just don't land, a few people are just eating and looking at each other and they're just saying these words that are on this page or making mistakes, or you just, oh, this is going badly.
You know, recently, or now and then people ask me, you know, if I have any tips on storytelling. And I was just thinking recently how when you watch those big action movies, I don't know if you go see big action movies, but they start with these absurd scenes. And they did in James Bond movies.
Yeah.
And they always start with the biggest, craziest fucking blowout that you just, and boom, they grab you so fast. And I think that it might be part of it, right? That you do have to, like, just lead out of the gate with the best thing you have. Because otherwise, nobody's going to get to page 10 or 12 or...
Yeah, you need to start as hot as possible and make sure it's working. You can't leave it for page 7. It's like if people write spec scripts, you know, and you say, well, you got to read past 15. It's like, man, if you don't grip... Everybody's busy. If you don't grip someone in 2 or 3 pages,
yeah,
they're not going to get to page 15.
You got to start on page 15.
Yeah.
Okay, so... You have written several books. Now, here's a quote from Bill Maher about your about Welcome to Dumbfuckistan. Bill Maher says, "A lot of what I believe, Ian Gurvitz has silver-tongued into a most readable, cathartic, and funny book. Congratulations, Ian Gurvitz, whoever you are." That was a wonderful plug, yeah?
Yeah, I've been lucky. You know, I have kind of some connection there, so
that's wonderful.
I'm able to get quotes from Bill every now and then.
Well, I hope you can get on his show. I think you'd be a perfect fit.
I've been dying to.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, did you ever want to write not political stuff? Did you ever just want to write novels or murder mysteries or anything like that?
I don't have it in me.
Because
I don't
have a novel in me. I mean, it seems like you've got this passion now for politics, like a lot of us do, and you speak so eloquently. I've heard you on some other shows, and I've looked at your books, and you're so bright. So it must be, it's a passion versus what you're doing, like sitcom writing, which is very, that's just a job.
You know, at times it's a job. I mean, that book, Welcome Dumbfuckistan, I was on a show on TV Land during the 5 years that I wrote this, but I would write mornings, weekends, and hiatuses. I told people I'm trying to write a book because I had no idea whether it was actually going to materialize or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it took 5 years. So my respite, you know, my oasis from doing the show, which was still fun, you know, half hour is fun. You get to sit in a room, people throw money at you and food at you, and you make jokes and stories, and it's a great way to earn a living. You know, and if you like what you're doing, it's, you know, even better.
And you can get any food you want, can't you?
No, you have to agree pretty
really?
Much every day. It's where are we going for lunch?
Because I dated this writer and he showed me the common area where there's food. And there was like a whiteboard and you could write anything on that.
Yeah.
You could write Raisinets and then the next day there'd be Raisinets.
You can put up a list.
Oh,
so
man.
You can
That's
choose your
else.
Junk food. The danger with TV is you start pounding the M&Ms too much if you're there for a lot of nights.
Yeah.
I mean, I looked at some pictures probably from the Wings days where, you know, I should have let go of the M&Ms.
Yeah, no kidding.
Got to work that off.
Yeah.
The danger is just you just sit and eat. You know, I mean, one thing I did, the reason I put out that book of drawings is for years I would just doodle on my script pages.
Yeah.
That's what I did instead of stuffing food in my mouth. And they started to look like things, so I saved them. And then at some point on this other show, there's a lot of downtime, mental downtime as we were doing it. So I just started scribbling again. It's like my head was there and my hand decided I'm going to go do something else. And they just started to look like things. So I ended up doing 100 of them and stuck some captions on and put them in a book. And my stepdaughter is a graphic designer, so she helped me with it. And so I did that. It was just more for fun.
I think that's great. I love that.
Yeah, it's just, I can't draw intentionally.
Yeah.
But I can draw accidentally.
Yeah. My buddy Dan O'Shannon is like that.
You know Dan? I know Dan pretty
yeah.
well.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Okay. So you're saying that when you write for the sitcom, you write for shows, you do the thing, but then you can go off and your heart and your wordsmith, you have an amazing language. Or listen to me. I can't even speak. You have an amazing command of words.
I've always written something else, no matter what show I was working on, if either a pilot, you know, or a movie script. I mean, I did an indie movie about 10 years ago and got it out, got it released. Gave me a lesson in doing that. Lesson in the indie film business. But
politics, it's always been in your heart.
It started with this first book. I just noticed that we seem to be letting stupidity into the political conversation. It started with Sarah Palin.
Right.
You know, and, you know, we got a little reprieve, but people forget, or at least they did forget at the moment, 60 million people voted for her. So she wasn't too stupid for 60 million people. But by the time, you know, I put that book out, it was April of 2016, the election was going on. It looked like Hillary would be the nominee, and then it was Cruz and Trump. But he was still a joke. You know, he was more dumb than dangerous.
Sure.
And as time went on and we got closer, even up until election night, what I told people is I didn't think he could win, but I was afraid she could lose.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that feeling all along, and I'd been writing for this website, attention.com, like month to month.
Attention.com?
Yeah.
How do you spell that, though?
Because it's ATTN.
Okay. ATTN,
have,
right.
Yeah.
So that's specific. Okay. And so we don't have a lot of time, and, you know,
sure.
I could go on. We could talk about politics forever.
Yeah, it
forever.
Seems to be in the air
it's
these
a
days.
Whole. It's a whole other show.
Yes, we're all
but let me
die.
Just ask you, what should Hillary have done?
I hit, watching this, there were two spots, but mainly, to me, it was the debates.
Mm-hmm.
For everything he was doing, with putting Clinton's exes in that press conference before that, she had him on a stage one-on-one, which was basically a heavyweight fight. They should have known what his psychological weaknesses were, which is being called stupid and being ridiculed, which he hates. to me, that's what drove him in the first place.
Yeah, because she kept doing that, you know, they go low, we go high.
No, big mistake.
But she should have gone lower.
She, you know, to me, it was when they go low, we go so fucking low, you can't imagine that we ever went that low.
Why couldn't she have just said, what are the three branches of government?
That's exactly.
Could he have answered that?
That's exactly the question that I thought she should have asked. And she should have worked it in there. She should have used language like, well, that's really uninformed. That's not very bright. You really don't know what you're talking about. It would have pushed all his buttons.
Yeah.
Also,
and saying things like, you know, you've intimidated women all your life, so it's not a surprise you're doing it here in front of all these people.
Yeah.
And you know, or like she should have called him out more.
The moral high ground wouldn't have worked, but would have worked, you know, in my imagination, would be outing him as an idiot. Again, ask him that question. What are the three branches of government? Name them. And if he hesitated for just a half a second, then you go at him and say, well, you don't really know, do you? So how are we supposed to elect someone? You've spent your lifetime in private service. I've spent a lifetime in public service. You know, you mock my marriage. Well, you know what? Marriage is tough. You should know you've had three of them. She should have just gotten tougher. Instead, it was that when they go low, we go high.
She kept her decorum. And she's also, though, her whole life has been about polishing herself and understanding how to handle these moments. Even in her new book, I didn't read it yet, but I read some excerpts, and it talks about, you know, she just, you know, never experienced anything like this. So she had nothing to draw from.
You know, look, the danger, obviously, if she had gotten excited, people would use the word shrill. So they would have come at her from any direction. What she could have done, you know, again, I wasn't the one up there, so it's easy to sit home and Monday morning quarterback it. Was just insult him subtly. His biggest fear is being made fun of. I mean, to me, that's what is driving this. It's that correspondence dinner in 2011 when the president just eviscerated him. He's out for revenge right now. You know, when he says the world is laughing at us, that's not what he means. What he means is, I don't like being laughed at. That's why he's using that language. This guy, I think she could have gotten to him. I think she could have taken him down and outed him as a moron. And an inexperienced one at that, and she could have, at the same time, looked tougher instead of just pointing at him as if it was self-evident.
Okay, so why can't the Democrats get together a candidate that can have smart writers like you explaining this shit? I mean, in other words, like, before she walks in the room as her boxing coach or her whatever, whoever's prepping her needs to say, listen, here's what's going to go down. We need to Jerry Springer this and go for it. I mean, but you're saying that now. Did you know that then, Ian?
I was yelling it at the TV.
You were yelling it at the TV.
I emailed somebody after that. I think it was the second debate. And
when he was hulking over her and standing behind
her? Yeah, and we were going back and forth. What did you think? And what I wrote at the time was, I think she blew a moment. Because they were riding this when they go low, we go high. You know, they were riding the moral high ground to what they thought would be victory. And frankly, who didn't? You know, but
because we live in a bubble, and I don't know those Trump supporters. I really don't know them. I mean, there are some Facebook friends, but I don't know. I think because I live on the coast. I don't know.
Well, what's been apparent to me is that there are only two camps. One camp voted for him because he was a racist. And the other camp voted for him in spite of him being a racist. So that's where they divide out. This guy has, you know, he's on, we're frankly, I think we're, everything we're going through right now, Charlottesville, response to this flood, it's all coming out of the dark mind of one man. The whole Russia investigation, it all springs from him. All the people around him are extensions of him. They're manifestations of him. We've let a maniac into the Oval Office.
So will he get impeached?
Who knows? You know, you watch and read, and you sort of read about what may be a move and a counter move. I don't think this House will vote to impeach. Now, if the Democrats retake it in 2018, they could vote to impeach, which would basically just be throwing marbles under his feet, because the Senate, which I don't think will swing back to the Democrats. In fact, there are more Democrats up than Republicans. They'll never vote to convict.
Yeah, but you're talking about what we know now. What we know tomorrow and what we know next week may completely change everything. And so, you know, that's the thing, Ian. I believe, like, nothing could surprise me anymore. Like, I could wake up and you could say, the Eiffel Tower is on fire, and I'd say, okay. Or, you know, you could say, the White House has been surrounded, I'd say, okay. Like, nothing surprises me.
Something so damning could come out that it'll force his hand and resign, but then what do we have? President Pence.
I really believe that anything is better than our children having to learn about Donald Trump even one more day.
No, even my kids know it. You know, and look.
I know, but I'm talking about like in the history books. Like it needs to see President Trump 2017. Like those are the numbers we need. I guess I'm just talking about like in the scope of our history. Hopefully, I just don't want him to cause a bigger stain than he already has.
Well, there is meaning to it. I think the history is the year we lost our minds. It was also to me a final backlash against the fact that we elected a black president,
and
the black president.
And they don't like it. They don't like it, right?
Yeah. It was, to me, this is like Reconstruction playing itself out all over again with the rise of the KKK and the John Birch Society. This was their last gasp. You know, so hopefully this will be the year we lost our minds, and then it all got straightened out. But even if he goes down, you lose the hate, you lose some of the stupidity, you lose the things that people scream at that TV's over, but you get President Pence, which is many of the same policies without the drama. So there's a part of me that's thinking, this guy is even more dangerous.
Yeah, but at least he wants to be in public service at some level.
Less hateful. I mean, but these are the categories we're stuck with right now.
I know, but anything is better than a reality show.
Oh, I agree. I want him gone.
Yeah.
Today, if not sooner. I'm just looking at it and go, how is this going to go down? Because the one thing this guy knows, he'll fight. He's a real fighter.
Yeah, he has nothing to lose.
He knows he wants to win like a shark knows he wants to eat. Right. That's all he knows. He's out for himself. He'll say anything. You know, there was that thing during the campaign where people said, don't take him literally, take him seriously. My attitude is, don't take him literally, do take him seriously, but most of all, take him tactically. Everything he says has a reason behind it. President Obama wiretapped me. That was to change the story. So the second either people in Congress or in the media buy into that nonsense, they've let him invade the conversation and change it.
They've engaged.
Yeah, they've took the bait. That's what this guy does. You know, even these pictures from the other day with Disaster Barbie in high heels getting into the helicopter. You know, all I could think was,
those were her casual stilettos.
Yeah, her casual disaster shoes. You know, and if she's Barbie, then if he was Ken, he gained a fuck ton of weight. Ken doll has really gone to shit.
Ian, you have so much to say, and you're so accomplished. Thank you so much for coming on. I mean, I could talk to you forever. Unfortunately, we don't have that time. You guys, get out there and buy the book Freak Out, The 2000 Election and the Dawn of the American Democalypse. And again, Ian will be at Book Soup on Sunday, October 1st at 4 o'clock. And thank you again so much for talking about the writer's room. I never can get enough of that. I find it fascinating, and I think that a lot of people out there don't really know how it works. So this was really, this was informative.
Thanks,
thank you.
It was fun.
All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up right now. I want to thank you so much again for tuning in today. Let Ian know how much you enjoyed his story, and you can find him over there on Twitter at iGurvitz. Of course, follow me over there as well at StoryWorthy.
And don't miss writer Brock Wilbur's story next week about his surprise Bosnian brother.
And my grandparents sit and think about it for a few days. And then they decide, we're going to get that kid out of Bosnia.
Don't miss this absolutely incredible story next week with Brock Wilbur.
All right, you guys, I want to thank everybody over at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez and Jeffrey Glazer. And once again, on behalf of you, Ian Gervitz, thank you so much. Thank you.
Awesome.
All right, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying make it a story worthy.
Can follow me. I'll take you down to the river. Follow me. I'll keep you safe.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.